Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now the weather. New York City had one of its worst ever air quality days on Tuesday, as you know, thanks to the raging wildfires way out in California and Oregon. Yes, the world is that small. Yesterday's rainfall cleared it out, but the fires are still raging, and the smoke is expected to return. The nation's biggest wildfire right now is called the Bootleg Fire in southern Oregon, more than 600 square miles burning. If you go camping in Oregon starting today, you're not allowed to have a campfire. Canada shattered its all-time record high temperature a few weeks ago. It was 121 degrees in Lytton, British Columbia, a full 8 degrees hotter than the old Canadian record of 113. 121 degrees in Canada. We've heard about the flooding in Germany. Central China had its heaviest rainfall ever this week. Here in New York, we've had an unusual concentration of tropical-style downpours this summer, right? Remember that subway flooding a couple of weeks ago? Are we now the northernmost outpost of the Caribbean? And the drought in the West, besides contributing to the wildfires, is causing worries about drinking water supplies in some places. The Times had a story this week called "A Drought So Dire, a Utah Town Pulled the Plug on Growth." So let's talk about the weather and its intersection with climate. Even that awful condo collapse in Miami has been blamed in part on the ground near the water there not being as stable as it used to be with the sea level rise that's taking place. With us now, Adam Sobel, director of Columbia University's Initiative on Extreme Weather and Climate and author of the book from 2014, Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate, and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. Thanks for coming on again, Professor Sobel. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Can you explain more about why we got all that smoke in the New York area this week from the Western wildfires? They have wildfires every year. That amount of smoke here was unusual.
Yeah, so the smoke from the fires gets up high enough that it, in some cases, and this was one of them, that it gets carried along by the prevailing westerly winds in the jet stream that bring it across the country. And so that's not so unusual. What was unusual was the amount of smoke, which is these fires are very intense. And also, what doesn't always happen is that it got mixed down to the surface. So you can have smoke higher up and not necessarily have it down to the ground, you know, because to get across the country, it has to be going at higher altitudes. But in this case, it did get mixed down to the ground. So we had that incredibly hazy day.
And what causes the wildfires to be so bad? You know, Donald Trump as president got some people believing it's because environmentalists like to preserve dense wild growth in the national forest. We know it's got to be more than that. But what causes the wildfires to be this bad?
Yeah, it's a combination of factors. The heat and drought are definitely big players. So if it's dry, then the fuels, which means, you know, the wood that's in trees and other plants, it will burn more easily. And if it's hot, that causes them to dry out more quickly. So that's definitely part of it. The fire is a complicated thing, so the management of the forest is not an irrelevant factor. And one way of managing for fire that's, you know, was practiced by indigenous peoples in many regions is to have controlled burns from time to time to prevent bigger ones. So, you know, it's not crazy to say that forest management has something to do with it, but it's also, I think, become quite clear that the warming climate in general and the drought conditions in the West in particular, which have other factors as well, just natural variability, is part of it. And I think we don't fully understand the story there, but it's pretty clear, I think, that the climate conditions are a significant factor in these fires.
Can you put some of these heat records into context for us? Canada's first ever 120 degree day. Portland, Oregon broke its all-time record by, I think, 8 degrees the other week. What's making that happen?
Yeah, this recent event in the Pacific Northwest was truly astonishing and frightening, frankly. It broke records across a large region of two countries, as you said, the U.S. and Canada, and didn't just break them by a little bit, but broke them by, I'll try to put this in Fahrenheit, 9 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Huge record-shattering event over a large area. So this is a really, really extreme event, and the lasting several days. It was caused, the proximate cause is the weather. I mean, it's the so-called heat dome. It's a large high-pressure system. In meteorologist language, we call it an omega block, basically a big deflection toward the north of the jet stream, so that, hot air sits in one place as the sun heats everything up. And, whether that's something that was just a very extreme case of that, it seems clear that the overall warmer climate due to human-induced greenhouse gases strengthened it. There was a rapid attribution study put out about 10 days after the event by a team of scientists internationally. I was not part of it. So they look comprehensively at all the different factors causing this event and try to assess how unusual was it, what's the probability that it could have occurred in a pre-industrial climate versus the probability that it could have occurred today. And they define it, the event as crossing some particular threshold. They argue it's about a 1,000-year event, taking into account all factors, in other words, including the present data. And but that it would have been an even more, much more unlikely event without human emissions of greenhouse gases. So you saw headlines that would have been almost impossible without the human influence. I mean, you could have still had an extreme heat wave without human influence, and we have had them in the past. But one this extreme is very difficult to explain without the human influence. Now, it's the scarier thing in some ways about this particular event is that it's difficult to explain even with human influence. In other words, there's some indications that maybe the models and other methods we use to understand these things are insufficiently, are missing something such that, this event was even more extreme than we would have expected even in the current climate. So it's definitely going to be studied for some time to come.
And listeners, everybody likes to talk about the weather. These days we like talking about the weather, and we also dread talking about the weather. So who wants to ask a question about the weather in 2021 and the 7-day forecast, the 7-year forecast, the 7-decade forecast with Adam Sobel, director of Columbia University's Initiative on Extreme Weather and Climate and author of the book Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. He also hosts a podcast called Deep Confection, 646 Convection, not Confection. Deep Confection would be a candy. Deep Convection relates to the climate. 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Professor Sobel, do you see the dryness, the drought in the western U.S. as cyclical or progressive? I mentioned that story about the Utah town that is seeing its water sources dry up so badly for years now, they've stopped trying to do building development.
Yeah, so drought has a variety of aspects to it. I think what's clear is that with temperatures being warmer, the water, whatever water is in the soil, evaporates more quickly. So any drought that's already happening is exacerbated by global warming. Now, the drought itself, the lack of rainfall, is a much more complicated question, and it's not clear that the so-called meteorological drought. So we talk about meteorological drought means the lack of rain, and hydrological drought means the lack of water in the ground, the soil, and in surface water reservoirs. And so what's clear is that the warming makes the hydrological drought worse given a meteorological drought. But the meteorological drought, the absence of rain, I think I may not be up on the very latest science of it. My understanding is that it's unclear. What we're seeing in the West could be natural variability what the climate models predict is drying over time in the Southwest. In California, shorter and heavier rainy season, so that you have drier weather on the front and back end of it. It's not, so these, what we're seeing now may fit those patterns to some extent, but it's a challenge to untangle the human and natural factors in these particular events.
And what do you see as the big picture implication of increasing dryness in the West? I'm thinking of the classic old movie Chinatown, which was about the power struggle for limited amount of water supplies that you could draw from the freshwater sources in Southern California. That movie is, 40 years old? And L.A. continued to grow nonetheless. So what are the implications of this?
The implications of it are very disturbing, not only in the American West, but in many other places in the world that have similar climates. Their competition for water is only going to get more extreme, not just because of both population growth in these regions and drying and using up of groundwater and so on. I mean, a lot of the growth in some of the dry areas of the U.S. West happened in the 1950s and 60s, which were relatively wet periods. Even if there was no climate change, that would have been a problem because it was sort of like set an optimistic standard for how many people could be supported on the water there. And agriculture, which uses huge amounts of water and so on. So maybe there's some policy responses that can help, but the long-term picture is certainly challenging.
And when we come back from a break, we'll start taking calls. But first, I'm going to ask you to move from the drought, which is obviously a huge deal in this country right now, as well as elsewhere in the world, to the incredible downpours that we've had here in New York City this summer, more than usual, that they're having in Germany, that they're having in China. If climate change is the cause, why would it be causing heavy rainfall as well as dryness at the same time? So we're going to ask you that question. We'll take phone calls as we continue with Adam Sobel from Columbia University on the intense weather that we're having around the world this summer. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue to talk about the intense weather in New York and around the world this summer and this year with Adam Sobel from Columbia University, director of their initiative on extreme weather and climate, host of the podcast Deep Convection, and author of the book Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. So as I teased before the break, Professor Sobel, at the same time as the drought, the issue elsewhere is heavy rains. I mentioned central China's heaviest rainfall on record this week. Germany and some other parts of Europe are having floods at a national crisis level. That's been in the news here. You were quoted in an Esquire magazine article 2 weeks ago that was called "These Videos of New York Subway and Apartment Floods Will Fill You with a Medium Amount of Existential Dread." That was the title of the article. So for people confused by this, could climate change be causing both droughts and floods?
Yes, I think it's important, though, to frame the question carefully. I mean, we don't want to underplay the role of human-induced climate change, but at the same time, we can never say that climate change caused a drought or a flood. It's the influence of human beings by emitting greenhouse gases and warming the climate is one factor among many. And any extreme event invariably has many factors. And to the extent we can distinguish the human cause from the natural ones are always a big factor. In other words, the weather's fluctuating always. It's always fluctuated. Most of what's going on is, it is just what the atmosphere would be doing anyway, but everything's a little warmer, so that changes the overall probability. So it's sort of like, imagine that there was some mild pollutant in the air that exacerbated a number of health conditions. Any individual humans' health problems would have many causes, of which that might only be a factor. And when you look over at the pattern, you might be very, very concerned about the influence of that mild pollutant, because it could be causing a lot of excess disease and death. But at the same time, in the individual would have a lot of other things going on with them, and that wouldn't be the only thing that was causing their problem. So I think it's important to make that distinction. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. But I think what you're getting at is, you know, how can it cause extremes of opposite types? I mean, dry extremes and wet extremes. And it certainly can play a role in both. So can and does in many cases. So what's happening in the global warming influence on extreme rain events is that in a warmer climate, all else equal, you have more water vapor in the air. And so the extreme rain events happen when other factors in the weather conspire to cause a lot of the water vapor in the air to be dumped out in one place and time, or some region and duration of time. And so if there's more water vapor in the air, because it's warmer, those events will cause more rain. But they're not doing it everywhere, right? They're only doing it there. And the same factors that cause that to happen when and where it does can be related to events that are causing droughts elsewhere. So in the latitudes we are in the United States, it's useful to talk about the jet stream, which is the belt of winds that blows from west to east. And it's related to the variations in temperature across the United States. You know, we're warmer in the south and colder in the north. And as the jet stream fluctuates around, a flood is often related to where it dips south and brings storms with it. And a heat wave or a drought is often related to where it dips, extends north, as it did in the Pacific Northwest event recently, or to some on a more long-term basis in the Northwest, the Western droughts in the U.S. So a more disturbed jet stream can simultaneously create heat and drought in some places and floods in other places. And I think that's what we've been seeing. There is some science over the last decade or so making the case that the more disturbed jet stream itself is a consequence of global warming. That is contentious in the scientific community. I'm not convinced by the evidence. Many of my colleagues aren't, and others are. And so that's something we're still debating. Certainly when we see these events, you know, it gives me pause, but I think it's nonetheless the notion that whether that part is caused by human influence or not, there's nothing contradictory about a warmer climate strengthening drought in some places and strengthening floods in others. And in fact, they're even a little bit related, because they both are related to the amount of water that can be in the vapor form in the air. So in a flood, you can have more water vapor in the air, and so that makes heavier rain when it dumps out. And in a drought, the air that's dry can also have more water vapor in it. It just doesn't. And so it evaporates out of the soil more quickly to make up that deficit. So the two are not totally unrelated in that way either.
Steve in Park Slope, you're on WNYC with Adam Sobel from Columbia's Extreme Weather Initiative. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian, and good morning, Dr. Sobel. My question is building off of this conversation about more water being in the atmosphere. And I'm wondering in New York specifically how in the coming years, as temperatures continue to rise, these extreme rain events will play out. My understanding is there's going to be more precipitation globally, but in New York specifically, is it only going to be a marginal change? Or might we see a big change? And basically, I'm just wondering, is there a chance here in New York we might see a storm event like Hurricane Harvey with extreme amounts of precipitation in a short amount of time happening here? Or are we not vulnerable to that?
Steve, thank you. Dr. Sobel?
We are vulnerable to that. I mean, Harvey was a very extreme event. It was a tropical cyclone that parked over the Houston area for a few days and rained very, very heavily. The climate up in New York is a little bit cooler, the probability of an event like that without having looked at the carefully, I'm pretty sure is a little bit lower to have something of quite that magnitude, but something with that kind of impact, broadly speaking, could definitely is possible, and the odds of it are increasing. About the global rainfall, I mean, actually, so one of the subtleties of climate change is that although there's more water vapor in the air, globally, over the total planet, the rate at which rainfall is increasing is, to the extent we can measure it, which is complicated because you have to measure rain in many, many places, but the rainfall is increasing slower than water vapor. So the global rainfall is controlled by, can you still hear me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. I had an internet issue. The global rainfall is controlled by the climate in different ways and doesn't increase as fast as water vapor does. But the extreme rain events are the ones that are very effective at squeezing out water vapor. So we do expect extreme rain events to intensify in New York State. And we see that in the data. The assessments that have been done for the United States show that the Northeast is one of the regions where extreme rain events are increasing most rapidly. I don't actually completely understand why that's the case, but that's what the observations show. Hmm. So yes, to answer the caller's question, the simple answer is yes, it's a serious concern.
And another listener tweets, listening from Broad Channel, that's on the water, and was literally considering this morning whether one corner of my house is sinking a bit. Window and door in that corner slowly creeping askew. But your book is about Hurricane Sandy. We haven't had another Sandy since the actual Sandy in 2012. Was there too much hyperbole about it at the time as being the new normal?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think, human beings have a tendency, the famous psychologist and author Daniel Kahneman refers to, and others refer to, as the availability bias. So we're most focused on things that have happened to us relatively recently and that we can sort of grasp on an emotional level for that reason. So when there had not been a storm like Sandy in, hundreds of years, I would say that government officials and certainly the public downplayed the risk of it. I mean, scientists knew that something like this was going to happen someday. There was warnings of it. And, we ignored it in building infrastructure and so on. I use the example of the South Ferry Station that was rebuilt in the same flood zone, even though it was well known from government studies that this would be flooded, one of the most vulnerable places. And, after those reports had been done, they built it and it flooded. So it was just the warnings weren't taken seriously. And then after it happened, this talk of the new normal, I mean, it remains a rare event. I mean, we still should not expect Sandy-like events to happen frequently in New York City or New York State. So it remains a rare event, even with climate change. We are even not sure whether the likelihood of a storm like that is increasing or decreasing in New York specifically. What we know is that sea level rise makes the risk of any such event greater. But so, Broad Channel certainly is a place that's at serious risk regardless. But yes, I think the answer is yes. Although I don't think, what Sandy did was it caused us to take the whole issue of our vulnerability to extreme weather events and to climate change more seriously. And to that extent, I don't think it was overhyped. But to the extent that people talked about a new normal and were asking, is this going to happen again next year? Yes, that was a little bit overblown.
And you mentioned sea level rise. Since we're pegging this whole conversation to a lot of extreme weather events that seem to be taking place all at the same time this summer, the Miami condo collapse. I saw you quoted in a story in USA Today called "As Rising Seas Erode Buildings, It's Getting Riskier to Live on the Coast." Can you draw that climate change connection for us just a little bit? I mean, I think people get sea level rise in general by now, but most of the press coverage seems to be focusing on building inspections that showed problems with that condo, but nobody acted on them.
Yeah, I don't have any special insight into that building in particular. I don't know to what extent sea level rise was a factor. We'll have to defer to the experts on that one. But a couple of things you can say. I mean, South Florida is a very low elevation. So it's prone to sea level rise for that reason alone. It is built on a porous rock, limestone, such that building seawalls around it doesn't work because the water can come in below them. So it doesn't, it's very difficult to defend South Florida against sea level rise. It's a hurricane prone region. You know, we can argue about how climate change is changing hurricanes. I think it's pretty clear it's making them stronger. But even if the hurricanes didn't change at all, when you have a region that's at higher risk of storm surge from hurricanes, any hurricane you have will create a worse flood to the extent that the sea starts from a higher place. So South Florida is definitely one of the places worst at risk, maybe the worst place at risk in the United States, and from this particular hazard. And you know, what that article was about was what this is going to do to the real estate market and the economy of that region and the country as a whole. And I'm really concerned about that. I mean, the concern being that there will be at some point people will realize that these risks are greater than they had thought, and that that could lead to a rapid collapse of the market that would be hard to come back from when the underlying, you know, whether or not it's rational at a given moment. In other words, you don't have to have hurricanes hitting every year. You don't have to have everything being underwater all the time for people to suddenly realize that the risk doesn't justify the kinds of investments that have been made there. And that'll be a big problem when that happens.
And to the listener who tweeted, great segment. Are we at a point that people should avoid buying coastal property in New Jersey or low-lying property in New York? I think you just got your answer, even though Dr. Sobel is a scientist, not a real estate advisor. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, almost out of time, with Adam Sobel from Columbia University's Initiative on Extreme Weather and Climate. But we're going to get one more phone call in here with a very practical question, I think. Richard in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I wanted to ask about the air quality index and the best way to check it locally. When the incident happened on Tuesday, and they said, no, it's, you know, not safe to be outside. The following morning when I was checking, like the Apple Weather app said, it's still unhealthy. But then my partner checks a different app and says, oh, no, it's fine. And so I Googled it, and you just get all kinds of answers. And I just didn't know what would be the best source.
Right. So air pollution is not my particular expertise, but I'm Googling it now. And if you go to the EPA is who really manages this at the government level. And if you go to the EPA, it guides you to a site called airnow.gov, AIRNOW.gov. And you can put in a zip code and get some air quality data. I'm looking at it now. It says air quality is good in New York City today. AQI, air quality index of 44, which is a pretty decent low number. So that's my first, that would be the first place I would look. I'm not sure what the different apps are doing. I would have thought that they're using essentially the same data, because that's what the weather apps do. You know, they're using the weather service data as their underlying information. And I would think the same would be true for air quality, but I don't know.
This is why we have experts on the show, sure, because they can Google things in their fields better than I can in real time. Last question. You were also quoted in an article last winter when they were having that bizarre deep freeze in Texas and elsewhere in the South. And I know that that made a lot of people at that time, and how quickly we forget. But if people wanted to be global warming skeptics and, you know, resist or become complacent about all these policies that we're debating at the policy level regarding climate, they could say, well, yeah, it's hot in the summer, but look how cold it was in the winter. It's never been that cold in Texas before.
Right. I mean, you know, it's nobody has, science is not predicting that winter will not occur anymore. It will still be cold in the winter, just a little bit, just less cold, which is definitely overall what the statistics show. It is less cold in winter. There are still extreme events. That was one of them. There are people, scientists, who argue along the lines that I was saying before about the wobbling jet stream, that such cold extremes are counterintuitively more probable because of global warming. I'm not convinced by that. But regardless, you know, in the same way, I don't think any one extreme event should be used as evidence for or against global warming. The evidence for global warming is much stronger than that. You know, we have measurements of temperature all over the world every day. We have satellite, you know, we can see it quite clearly. And the extreme events are the rare thing. So I think that's, I could talk about this for a long time, obviously, but I think that that's a misguided and an inconsistent way to look at the evidence.
Yeah, and your bottom line message about looking at the longer term trends, not individual events, certainly applies. And when you look at the average annual global temperatures year after year after year since the turn of this century, we've been setting records for annual average temperature worldwide. And we leave it there with Columbia University's Director of the Initiative on Extreme Weather and Climate, Adam Sobel. He's also host of the podcast Deep Convection and author of the book Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brian.